known to the part of the world that mattered as Milkman Dead. And as if that were not enough, a sister named Pilot Dead, who would never mention to her brother the circumstances or the details of this foolish misnaming of his son, because the whole thing would have delighted her. She would savor it, maybe fold it too in a brass box and hang it from her other ear. He had cooperated as a young father with the blind selection of names from the Bible for every child other than the first male, and abided by whatever the finger pointed to, for he knew every configuration of the naming of his sister. How his father, confused and melancholy over his wife's death in childbirth, had thumbed through the Bible, and since he could not read a word, chose a group of letters that seemed to him strong and handsome, saw in them a large figure that looked like a tree hanging in some princely but protective way over a row of smaller trees. How he had copied the group of letters out on a piece of brown paper, copied, as illiterate people do, every curly Q, arch, and bend in the letters, and presented it to the midwife. That's the baby's name. You want this for the baby's name? I want that for the baby's name. Say it. You can't name the baby this. Say it. It's a man's name. Say it. Pilot. What? Pilot. You wrote down pilot. Like a riverboat pilot? No. Not like no riverboat pilot. Like a Christ-killing pilot. You can't get much worse than that for a name. And a baby girl at that? That's where my finger went down. Well, your brain ain't got to follow it. You don't want to give this motherless child the name of the man that killed Jesus, do you? I asked Jesus to save me my wife. Careful, Macon. I asked him all night long. He give you your baby? Yes, he did. Baby named Pilot. Jesus, have mercy. Where you going with that piece of paper? It's going right back where it came from. Right in the devil's flames. Give it here. It come from the Bible. It stays in the Bible. And it did stay there until the baby girl turned 12 and took it out, folded it up into a tiny knot, and put it in a little brass box and strung the entire contraption through her left earlobe. Fluky about her own name at 12. How much more fluky she'd become since then, Macon could only guess. But he knew for certain that she would treat the naming of the third Macon dead with the same respect and awe she had treated the boy's birth. Macon dead remembered when his son was born how she seemed to be more interested in this first nephew of hers than she was in her own daughter, and even that daughter's daughter. Long after Ruth was up and about, as capable as she ever would be, and that wasn't much, of running the house again, Pilot continued to visit, her shoelaces undone, a knitted cap pulled down over her forehead, bringing her foolish earring and sickening smell into the kitchen. He had not seen her since he was 16 years old, until a year before the birth of his son, when she appeared in his city. Now she was acting like an in-law, like an aunt, dabbling at helping Ruth and the girls, but having no interest in or knowledge of decent housekeeping. She got in the way. Finally, she just sat in a chair near the crib, singing to the baby. That wasn't so bad, but what Macon Dead remembered most was the expression on her face. Surprise, it looked like, an eagerness, but so intense it made him uneasy. Or perhaps it was more than that. Perhaps it was seeing her all those years after they had separated outside that cave and remembering his anger and her betrayal. How far down she had slid since then. She had cut the last thread of propriety. At one time, she had been the dearest thing in the world to him. Now she was odd, murky, and worst of all, unkempt, a regular source of embarrassment, if he would allow it. But he would not allow it. Finally, he had told her not to come again, until she could show some respect for herself, could get a real job instead of running a wine house. Why can't you dress like a woman? He was standing by the stove. What's that sailor's cap doing on your head? Don't you have stockings? What are you trying to make me look like in this town? He trembled with the thought of the white men in the bank, the men who helped him buy and mortgage houses, discovering that this raggedy bootlegger was his sister, that the property Negro who handled his business so well and who lived in the big house on Not Doctor Street had a sister who had a daughter but no husband, and that daughter had a daughter but no husband, a collection of lunatics who made wine and sang in the streets like common street women, just like common street women. Pilate had sat there listening to him, her wandering eyes resting on his face. Then she said, I've been worried sick about you too, Macon. Exasperated, he had gone to the kitchen door. Go ahead, Pilate. Go on now. I'm on the thin side of evil and trying not to break through. Pilate stood up, wrapped her quilt around her, and with a last fond look at the baby, left through the kitchen door. She never came back. When Macon Dead got to the front door of his office, he saw a stout woman and two young boys standing a few feet away. Macon unlocked his door, walked over to his desk, and settled himself behind it. As he was thumbing through his accounts book, the stout woman entered alone. Afternoon, Mr. Dead, sir. I'm Mrs. Baines. Live over at number 3 on 15th Street. Macon Dead remembered. Not the woman, but the circumstances at number 3. His tenant's grandmother or aunt or something had moved in there, and the rent was long overdue. Yes, Mrs. Baines, you got something for me? Well, that's what I come to talk to you about. You know, since he left all them babies with me, and my relief check ain't no more than it take to keep a well-grown yard dog alive. Half alive, I should say. Your rent is $4 a month, Mrs. Baines. You 2 months behind already. I do know that, Mr. Dead, sir. But babies can't make it with nothing to put in their stomach. Their voices were low, polite, without any hint of conflict. Can they make it in the street, Mrs. Baines? That's where they're going to be, if you don't figure out some way to get me my money. No, sir. They can't make it in the street. We need both, I reckon. Same as yours does. Then you better rustle it up, Mrs. Baines. You got till... He swiveled around to consult the calendar on the wall. Till Saturday coming. Saturday, Mrs. Baines. Not Sunday. Not Monday. Saturday. If she had been younger and had more juice, the glitter in her eyes would have washed down onto her cheeks. Now, at her time of life, it simply gleamed. She pressed the flat of her hand on Macondead's desk, and holding the gleam steady in her eyes, pushed herself up from the chair. She turned her head a little to look out the plate glass window and then back at him. What's it gonna profit you, Mr. Dead Sir, to put me and them children out? Saturday, Mrs. Baines. Lowering her head, Mrs. Baines whispered something and walked slowly and heavily from the office. As she closed the door to Sonny's shop, her grandchildren moved out of the sunlight into the shadow where she stood. What'd he say, Granny? Mrs. Baines put a hand on the taller boy's hair and fingered it lightly, absently searching with her nails for tetter spots. He must have told her no, said the other boy. Do we got to move? The tall boy tossed his head free of her fingers and looked at her sideways. His cat eyes were gashes of gold. Mrs. Baines let her hand fall to her side. A nigger in business is a terrible thing to see. A terrible, terrible thing to see. The boys looked at each other and back at their grandmother. Their lips were parted as though they had heard something important. When Mrs. Baines closed the door, Macondead went back to the pages of his accounts book, running his fingertips over the figures and thinking with the unoccupied part of his mind about the first time he called on Ruth Foster's father. He had only two keys in his pocket then, and if he had let people like the woman who just left have their way, he wouldn't have had any keys at all. It was because of those keys that he could dare to walk over to that part of Not Doctor Street. It was still Doctor Street then, and approach the most important Negro in the city. To lift the lion's paw knocker, to entertain thoughts of marrying the doctor's daughter, was possible because each key represented a house which he owned at the time. Without those keys, he would have floated away at the doctor's first word. Yes? Or he would have melted like new wax under the heat of that pale eye. Instead, he was able to say that he had been introduced to his daughter, Miss Ruth Foster, and would appreciate having the doctor's permission to keep her company now and then. That his intentions were honorable, and that he himself was certainly worthy of the doctor's consideration as a gentleman friend for Miss Foster, since at 25 he was already a colored man of property. I don't know anything about you, the doctor said, other than your name, which I don't like. But I will abide by my daughter's preference. In fact, the doctor knew a good deal about him, and was more grateful to this tall young man than he ever allowed himself to show. Fond as he was of his only child, useful as she was in his house since his wife had died, Lately he had begun to chafe under her devotion. Her steady beam of love was unsettling, and she had never dropped those expressions of affections that had been so lovable in her childhood. The goodnight kiss was itself a masterpiece of slow-wittedness on her part and discomfort on his. At 16, she still insisted on having him come to her at night, sit on her bed, exchange a few pleasantries, and plant a kiss on her lips. Perhaps it was the loud silence of his dead wife. Perhaps it was Ruth's disturbing resemblance to her mother. More probably, it was the ecstasy that always seemed to be shining in Ruth's face when he bent to kiss her, an ecstasy he felt inappropriate to the occasion. None of that, of course, did he describe to the young man who came to call, which is why Makenbed still believed the magic had lain in the two keys. In the middle of his reverie, Maken was interrupted by rapid tapping on the window. He looked up, saw Freddy peeping through the gold lettering, and nodded for him to enter. A gold-toothed bantamweight, Freddy was as much of a town crier as Southside had. It was the same rapid tapping on the window pane, the same flash of gold smile that had preceded his now famous scream to Macon. Mr. Smith went splat. It was obvious to Macon that Freddy now had news of another calamity. Porter gone crazy drunk again. Got his shotgun. Who's he out for? Macon began closing books and opening desk drawers. Porter was a tenant, and tomorrow was collection day. Ain't out for nobody in particular. Just perched himself up in the attic window and commenced to waving a shotgun. Say he gotta kill him somebody before morning. He go to work today? Yep. Caught the eagle, too. Drunk it all up? Not all of it. He only got one bottle, and he still got a fistful of money. Who's crazy enough to sell him any liquor? Freddy showed a few gold teeth, but said nothing, so Maker knew it was Pilot. He locked all his drawers, save one, the one he unlocked and took a small .32 from. Police warn every bootlegger in the county, and he still gets it somehow. Macon went on with the charade, pretending he didn't know his sister was the one Porter, and anybody else, adult, child, or beast, could buy wine from. He thought for the 100th time that she needed to be in jail, and he would be willing to put her there if he could be sure she wouldn't loudmouth him and make him seem trashy in the eyes of the law and the banks. You know how to use that thing, Mr. Dead, sir? I know how. Porter's crazy when he's drunk. I know what he is. How you aiming to get him down? I ain't aiming to get him down. I'm aiming to get my money down. He can go on and die up there if he wants to. But if he don't toss me my rent, I'm gonna blow him out of that window. Freddy's giggle was soft, but his teeth strengthened its impact. A born flunky, he loved gossip and the telling of it. He was the ear that heard every murmur of complaint, every name calling, and his was the eye that saw everything, the secret loving glances, the fights, the new dresses. Macon knew Freddy as a fool and a liar, but a reliable liar. He was always right about his facts and always wrong about the motives that produced the facts. Just as now he was right about Porter having a shotgun, being in the attic window and being drunk. But Porter was not waiting to kill somebody, meaning anybody, before morning. In fact, he was very specific about whom he wanted to kill. Himself. However, he did have a precondition, which he shouted down loud and clear from the attic. I want to fuck. Send me up somebody to fuck. Hear me? Send me up somebody, I tell ya. Or I'm going to blow my brains out. As Macon and Freddie approached the yard, the women from the rooming house were hollering answers to Porter's plea. What kind of bargain is that? Kill yourself first, and then we'll send you somebody. Do it have to be a woman? Do it gotta be human? Do it gotta be alive? Can it be a piece of liver? Put that thing down and throw me my goddamn money. Macon's voice cut through the women's fun. Float those dollars down here, nigger, then blow yourself up. Porter turned and aimed his shotgun at Macon. If you pull that trigger, shouted Macon, you better not miss. If you take a shot, you better make sure I'm dead, 'cause if you don't, I'm gonna shoot your balls up in your throat. He pulled out his own weapon. Now get the hell out of that window. Porter hesitated for only a second before turning the barrel of the shotgun toward himself, or trying to. Its length made it difficult. His drunkenness made it impossible. Struggling to get the right angle, he was suddenly distracted. He leaned his shotgun on the windowsill, pulled out his penis, and in a high arc, peed over the heads of the women, making them scream and run in a panic that the shotgun had not been able to create. Macon rubbed the back of his head while Freddie bent double with laughter. For more than an hour, Porter held him at bay, cowering, screaming, threatening, urinating, and interspersing all of it with pleas for women. He would cry great shoulder-heaving sobs, followed by more screams. I love you. I love you all. Don't act like that, you women. Stop it. Don't act like that. Don't you see I love you? I'd die for you, kill for you. I'm saying I love you. I'm telling you, oh God, have mercy. What am I gonna do? What in this fucking world am I gonna do? Tears streamed down his face, and he cradled the barrel of the shotgun in his arms as though it were the woman he had been begging for, searching for all his life. Give me hate, Lord, he whimpered. I'll take hate any day. But don't give me love. I can't take no more love, Lord. I can't carry it. Just like Mr. Smith, he couldn't carry it. It's too heavy. Jesus, you know. You know all about it. Ain't it heavy? Jesus, ain't love heavy? Don't you see, Lord? Your own son couldn't carry it. If it killed him, what you think it's gonna do to me, huh? Huh? He was getting angry again. Come down out of there, nigger. Macon's voice was still loud, but it was getting weary. And you, you baby dick baboon, he tried to point at Macon. You the worst. You need killing. You really need killing. You know why? Well, I'm gonna tell you why. I know why. Everybody. Porter slumped down in the window, muttering, everybody know why, and fell asleep. As he sank deeper into it, the shotgun slipped from his hand, rattled down the roof, and hit the ground with a loud explosion. The shot zipped past a bystander's shoe and blew a hole in the tire of a stripped Dodge parked in the road. "Go get my money," Megan said. "Me?" Freddy asked. "Suppose he..." "Go get me my money." Porter was snoring. Through the blast of the gun and the picking of his pocket, he slept like a baby. When Megan walked out of the yard, the sun had disappeared behind the bread company. Tired, irritable, he walked down 15th Street, glancing up as he passed one of his other houses, its silhouette melting in the light that trembled between dusk and twilight. Scattered here and there, his houses stretched up beyond him like squat ghosts with hooded eyes. He didn't like to look at them in this light. During the day, they were reassuring to see. Now they did not seem to belong to him at all. In fact, he felt as though the houses were in league with one another to make him feel like the outsider, the propertyless, landless wanderer. It was this feeling of loneliness that made him decide to take a shortcut back to Not Doctor Street, even though to do so would lead him past his sister's house. In the gathering darkness, he was sure his passing would be unnoticed by her. He crossed a yard and followed a fence that led to Darling Street, where Pilot lived in a narrow, single-story house whose basement seemed to be rising from rather than settling into the ground. She had no electricity because she would not pay for the service, nor for gas. At night, she and her daughter lit the house with candles and kerosene lamps. They warmed themselves and cooked with wood and coal, pumped kitchen water into a dry sink through a pipeline from a well, and lived pretty much as though progress was a word that meant walking a little farther on down the road. Her house sat 80 feet from the sidewalk and was backed by 4 huge pine trees from which she got the needles she stuck into her mattress. Seeing the pine trees started him thinking about her mouth, how she loved, as a girl, to chew pine needles, and as a result, smelled even then like a forest. For a dozen years, she had been like his own child. After their mother died, she had come struggling out of the womb without help from throbbing muscles or the pressure of swift room water. As a result, for all the years he knew her, her stomach was as smooth and sturdy as her back, at no place interrupted by a navel. It was the absence of a navel that convinced people that she had not come into this world through normal channels, had never lain, floated, or grown in some warm and liquid place connected by a tissue-thin tube to a reliable source of human nourishment. Megan knew otherwise, because he was there, and had seen the eyes of the midwife as his mother's legs collapsed, and heard as well her shouts when the baby, who they believed was dead also, inched its way headfirst out of a still, silent, and indifferent cave of flesh, dragging her own cord and her own afterbirth behind her. But the rest was true. Once the new baby's lifeline was cut, the cord stump shriveled, fell off, and left no trace of having ever existed, which, as a young boy taking care of his baby sister, he thought no more strange than a bald head. He was 17 years old, irreparably separated from her, and already pressing forward in his drive for wealth, when he learned that there was probably not another stomach like hers on earth. Now, nearing her yard, he trusted that the dark would keep anyone in her house from seeing him. He did not even look to his left as he walked by it. But then he heard the music. They were singing, all of them. Pilot, Reba, and Reba's daughter, Hagar. There was no one on the street that he could see. People were at supper, licking their fingers, blowing into saucers of coffee, and no doubt chattering about Porter's escapade and Macon's fearless confrontation of the wild man in the attic. There were no street lights in this part of town. Only the moon directed the way of a pedestrian. Macon walked on, resisting as best he could the sound of the voices that followed him. He was rapidly approaching a part of the road where the music could not follow, when he saw, like a scene on the back of a postcard, a picture of where he was headed, his own home, his wife's narrow, unyielding back, his daughter's boiled dry from years of yearning, his son, to whom he could speak only if his words held some command or criticism. "Hello, Daddy." "Hello, son. Tuck your shirt in." "I found a dead bird, Daddy. Don't bring that mess in this house." There was no music there, and tonight he wanted just a bit of music from the person who had been his first caring for. He turned back and walked slowly toward Pilot's house. They were singing some melody that Pilot was leading, a phrase that the other two were taking up and building on. Her powerful contralto, Reba's piercing soprano in counterpoint, and the soft voice of the girl, Hagar, who must be about 10 or 11 now, pulled him like a carpet tack under the influence of a magnet. Surrendering to the sound, Macon moved closer. He wanted no conversation, no witness, only to listen and perhaps to see the three of them, the source of that music that made him think of fields and wild turkey and calico. Treading as lightly as he could, he crept up to the side window where the candlelight flickered lowest and peeped in. Reba was cutting her toenails with a kitchen knife or a switchblade, her long neck bent almost to her knees. The girl, Hagar, was braiding her hair, while Pilot, whose face he could not see because her back was to the window, was stirring something in a pot. Wine pulp, perhaps. Macon knew it was not food she was stirring, for she and her daughters ate like children, whatever they had a taste for. No meal was ever planned or balanced or served, nor was there any gathering at the table. Pilot might bake hot bread, and each one of them would eat it with butter whenever she felt like it. Or there might be grapes left over from winemaking, or peaches for days on end. If one of them bought a gallon of milk, they drank it until it was gone. If another got a half bushel of tomatoes or a dozen ears of corn, they ate them until they were gone too. They ate what they had or came across or had a craving for. Profits from their wine selling evaporated like seawater in a hot wind, going for junk jewelry for Hagar, Reber's gifts to men, and he didn't know what all. Near the window, hidden by the dark, he felt the irritability of the day drain from him and relished the effortless beauty of the women singing in the candlelight. Reba's soft profile, Hager's hands moving in her heavy hair. And Pilot, he knew her face better than he knew his own. Singing now, her face would be a mask. All emotion and passion would have left her features and entered her voice. But he knew that when she was neither singing nor talking, her face was animated by her constantly moving lips. She chewed things. As a baby, as a very young girl, she kept things in her mouth. Straw from brooms, gristle, buttons, seeds, leaves, string, and her favorite, when he could find some for her, rubber bands and India rubber erasers. Her lips were alive with small movements. If you were close to her, you wondered if she was about to smile, or was she merely shifting a straw from the baseline of her gums to her tongue. Perhaps she was dislodging a curl of rubber band from inside her cheek, or was she really smiling? From a distance, she appeared to be whispering to herself. When she was only nibbling or splitting tiny seeds with her front teeth, her lips were darker than her skin, wine-stained, blueberry-dyed, so her face had a cosmetic look, as though she had applied a very dark lipstick neatly and blotted away its shine on a scrap of newspaper. As Macon felt himself softening under the weight of memory and music, the song died down. The air was quiet, and yet Macon Dead could not leave. He liked looking at them freely this way. They didn't move. They simply stopped singing, and Reba went on paring her toenails. Hager threaded and unthreaded her hair, and Pilot swayed like a willow over her stirring. Chapter 2. Only Magdalene Colina and First Corinthians were genuinely happy when the big Packard rolled evenly and silently out of the driveway. They alone had a sense of adventure and were flagrant in their enjoyment of the automobile's plushness. Each had a window to herself and commanded an unobstructed view of the summer day flying past them. And each was both old enough and young enough to actually believe she was a princess riding in a regal chariot driven by a powerful coachman. In the back seat, away from the notice of Macon and Ruth, they slipped off their patent leather pumps, rolled their stockings down over their knees, and watched the men walking down the streets. These rides that the family took on Sunday afternoons had become rituals and much too important for Macon to enjoy. For him, it was a way to satisfy himself that he was indeed a successful man. It was a less ambitious ritual for Ruth, but a way nevertheless for her to display her family. For the little boy, it was simply a burden. Pressed in the front seat between his parents, he could see only the winged woman careening off the nose of the car. He was not allowed to sit on his mother's lap during the drive, not because she wouldn't have it, but because his father objected to it. So it was only by kneeling on the dove gray seat and looking out the back window that he could see anything other than the laps, feet, and hands of his parents, the dashboard, or the silver-winged woman poised at the tip of the Packard. But riding backward made him uneasy. It was like flying blind and not knowing where he was going, just where he had been, troubled him. He did not want to see trees that he had passed, or houses and children slipping into the space the automobile had left behind. Macon Dead's Packard rolled slowly down Not Doctor Street, through the rough part of town, later known as the Blood Bank because blood flowed so freely there. Over the bypass downtown and headed for the wealthy white neighborhoods, some of the black people who saw the car passing by sighed with good-humored envy at the classiness, the dignity of it. In 1936, there were very few among them who lived as well as Macon Dead. Others watched the family gliding by with a tiny bit of jealousy and a whole lot of amusement, for Macon's wide green Packard belied what they thought a car was for. He never went over 20 miles an hour, never gunned his engine, never stayed in first gear for a block or two to give pedestrians a thrill. He had never blown a tire, never ran out of gas, and needed 12 grinning, raggle-tail boys to help him push it up a hill or over to a curb. No rope ever held the door to its frame, and no teenagers leaped on his running board for a lift down the street. He hailed no one, and no one hailed him. There was never a sudden breaking and backing up to shout or laugh with a friend. No beer bottles or ice cream cones poked from the open windows, nor did a baby boy stand up to pee out of them. He never let rain fall on it if he could help it, and he walked to Sonny's shop, taking the car out only on these occasions. What's more, they doubted that he had ever taken a woman into the back seat, because rumor was that he went to bad houses, or lay sometimes with a slack or lonely female tenant. Other than the bright and roving eyes of Magdalene called Lena and First Corinthians, the Packard had no real lived life at all. So they called it Macon Dead's hearse. First Corinthians pulled her fingers through her hair. It was long, lightweight hair, the color of wet sand. "Are you going any place special, or are we just driving around?" She kept her eyes on the street, watching the men and women walking by. "Careful, Macon, you always take the wrong turn here." Ruth spoke softly from the right side of the car. "Do you want to drive?" Macon asked her. "You know I don't drive," she answered. "Then let me do it." "All right, but don't blame me if..." Macon pulled smoothly into the left fork of the road that led through downtown and into a residential area. "Daddy, are we going any special place?" "Honoré," Macon said. Magdalene Colina pushed her stockings farther down on her legs. "On the lake? What's out there? There's nothing out there. Nobody." "There's a beach community out there, Lena. Your father wants to look at it." Ruth reasserted herself into the conversation. "What for? Those are white people's houses," said Lena. "All of it's not white people's houses. Some of it's nothing, just land, way over on the other side. It could be a nice summer place for colored people, beach houses. You understand what I mean? Macon glanced at his daughter through the rearview mirror. Who's going to live in them? There's no colored people who can afford to have two houses, Lena said. Reverend Coles can, and Dr. Singleton. Corinthians corrected her. And that lawyer, what's his name? Ruth looked around at Corinthians, who ignored her. And Mary, I suppose, Lena laughed. Corinthians stared coldly at her sister. Daddy wouldn't sell property to a barmaid. Daddy, would you let us live next to a barmaid? She owns that place, Corinthians, Ruth said. I don't care what she owns. I care about what she is. Daddy, Corinthians leaned toward her father for confirmation. You're going too fast, Macon. Ruth pressed the toe of her shoe against the floorboard. If you say one more thing to me about the way I drive, you're going to walk back home. I mean it. Magdalene, called Lena, sat forward and put her hand on her mother's shoulder. Ruth was quiet. The little boy kicked his feet against the underside of the dashboard. Stop that, Macon told him. I have to go to the bathroom, said his son. Corinthians held her head. Oh, Lord. But you went before we left, said Ruth. I have to go, he was beginning to whine. Are you sure? His mother asked him. He looked at her. I guess we better stop, Ruth said to nobody in particular. Her eyes grazed the countryside they were entering. Macon didn't alter his speed. Are we going to have a summer place, or are you just selling property? I'm not selling anything. I'm thinking of buying and then renting, Macon answered her. But are we? I have to go, said the little boy. Going to live there too? Maybe. By ourselves? Who else? Corinthians was very interested. I can't tell you that, but in a few years, 5 or 10, a whole lot of coloreds will have enough to afford it. A whole lot. Take my word for it. Magdalene called Lena, took a deep breath. Up ahead you could pull over, Daddy. He might mess up the seat. Macon glanced at her in the mirror and slowed down. Who's going to take him? Ruth fiddled with the door handle. Not you, Macon said to her. Ruth looked at her husband. She parted her lips, but didn't say anything. Not me, said Corinthians. I have on high heels. Come on, Lena sighed. They left the car, the little boy and big sister, and disappeared into the trees that reared up off the shoulder of the road. You really think there'll be enough colored people? I mean nice colored people in this city to live there? They don't have to be from this city, Corinthians. People will drive to a summer house. White people do it all the time. Macon drummed his fingers on the steering wheel, which trembled a little as the car idled. Negroes don't like the water, Corinthians giggled. They'll like it if they own it, said Macon. He looked out the window and saw Magdalene call Lena coming out of the trees. A large, colorful bouquet of flowers was in her hand, but her face was crumpled in anger. Over her pale blue dress, dark, wet stains spread like fingers. He wet on me, she said. He wet me, Mama. She was close to tears. Ruth clucked her tongue. Corinthians laughed. I told you, Negroes don't like water. He didn't mean it. It happened before he was through. She stepped away from him to pick flowers, returned, and at the sound of her footsteps behind him, he turned around before he was through. It was becoming a habit, this concentration on things behind him, almost as though there were no future to be had. But if the future did not arrive, the present did extend itself, and the uncomfortable little boy in the Packard went to school, and at 12 met the boy who not only could liberate him, but could take him to the woman who had as much to do with his future as she had his past. Guitar said he knew her, had even been inside her house. "What's it like in there?" Milkman asked him. "Shiny," Guitar answered, "shiny and brown, with a smell." "A bad smell?" "I don't know. Her smell. You'll see." All those unbelievable but entirely possible stories about his father's sister and the woman his father had forbidden him to go near had both of them spellbound. Neither wished to live one more day without finding out the truth, and they believed they were the legitimate and natural ones to do so. After all, Guitar already knew her, and Milkman was her nephew. They found her on the front steps, sitting wide-legged in a long-sleeved, long-skirted black dress. Her hair was wrapped in black, too, and from a distance, all they could really see beneath her face was the bright orange she was peeling. She was all angles, he remembered later. Knees, mostly, and elbows. One foot pointed east, and one pointed west. As they came closer and saw the brass box dangling from her ear, Milkman knew that, what with the earring, the orange, and the angled black cloth, nothing, not the wisdom of his father, nor the caution of the world, could keep him from her. Guitar, being older and already in high school, had none of the reluctance that his young buddy still struggled with, and he was the first one to speak. "Hi." The woman looked up, first at Guitar, and then at Milkman. "What kind of word is that?" Her voice was light, but gravel sprinkled. Milkman kept on staring at her fingers, manipulating the orange. Guitar grinned and shrugged. "It means hello." "Then say what you mean." "Okay, hello." "That's better. What you want?" "Nothing. We just passing by." "Look like you're standing by." "If you don't want us here, Miss Pilot, we'll go." Guitar spoke softly. "I ain't the one with the wants. You the one wants something. We want to ask you something." Guitar stopped feigning indifference. She was too direct, and to keep up with her, he had to pay careful attention to his language. "Ask it. Somebody said you ain't got no navel. That the question?" "Yes." "Don't sound like a question. Sound like an answer. Give me the question." "Do you? Do I what? Do you have a navel?" "No." "What happened to it?" "Beats me." She dropped a bright peeling into her lap and separated an orange section slowly. "Now do I get to ask a question?" "Sure. Who's your little friend?" "This here's Milkman." "Do he talk?" Pilot swallowed a piece of the fruit. "Yeah, he talk. Say something." Guitar shoved an elbow at Milkman without taking his eyes off Pilot. Milkman took a breath, held it, and said, "Hi." Pilot laughed. "You all must be the dumbest unhung Negroes on earth. What they telling you in them schools? You say hi to pigs and sheep when you want them to move. When you tell a human being hi, he ought to get up and knock you down. Shame had flooded him. He had expected to feel it, but not that kind. To be embarrassed, yes, but not that way. She was the one who was ugly, dirty, poor, and drunk. The queer aunt, whom his sixth-grade schoolmates teased him about, and whom he hated because he felt personally responsible for her ugliness, her poverty, her dirt, and her wine. Instead, she was making fun of his school, of his teachers, of him. And while she looked as poor as everyone said she was, something was missing from her eyes that should have confirmed it. Nor was she dirty. Unkempt, yes, but not dirty. The whites of her fingernails were like ivory, and unless he knew absolutely nothing, this woman was definitely not drunk. Of course she was anything but pretty, yet he knew he could have watched her all day. The fingers pulling thread veins from the orange sections. The berry black lips that made her look as though she wore makeup. The earring. And when she stood up, he all but gasped. She was as tall as his father, head and shoulders taller than himself. Her dress wasn't as long as he had thought. It came to just below her calf. And now he could see her unlaced men's shoes and the silvery brown skin of her ankles. She held the peelings precisely as they had fallen in her lap. And as she walked up the steps, she looked as though she were holding her crutch. Your daddy wouldn't like that. He don't like dumb people. Then she looked right at Milkman, one hand holding the peelings, the other on the doorknob. I know your daddy. I know you too. Again, Guitar spoke up. You his daddy's sister? The only one he got. Ain't but three deads alive. Milkman, who had been unable to get one word out of his mouth, after the foolish hi, he heard himself shouting, I'm a dead. My mother's a dead. My sisters, you and him ain't the only ones. Even while he was screaming, he wondered why was he suddenly so defensive, so possessive about his name. He had always hated that name, all of it. And until he and Guitar became friends, he had hated his nickname too. But in Guitar's mouth, it sounded clever, grown up. Now he was behaving with this strange woman, as though having the name was a matter of deep personal pride, as though she had tried to expel him from a very special group in which he not only belonged, but had exclusive rights. In the heartbeat of silence that followed his shouts, Pilot laughed. You all want a soft-boiled egg? She asked. The boys looked at each other. She changed rhythm on them. They didn't want an egg, but they did want to be with her, to go inside the wine house of this lady who had one earring, no navel, and looked like a tall black tree. No thanks, but we'd like a drink of water, Guitar smiled back at her. Well, step right in. She opened the door, and they followed her into a large, sunny room that looked both barren and cluttered. A moss-green sack hung from the ceiling. Candles were stuck in bottles everywhere. Newspaper articles and magazine pictures were nailed to the walls. But other than a rocking chair, two straight-back chairs, a large table, a sink and stove. There was no furniture. pervading everything was the odor of pine.